Hello, Cavalier fans. It is Bob Schmidt, your Cavalier podcast host. This is the Fear the Fro podcast, and we are about to take on the New Orleans Pelicans on the road, a team which trounced us in December. We were very shorthanded. No Mobley, no Garland, no Donovan Mitchell. Trey Murphy dropped 28 points on our head and 6 3-pointers. Tonight, we get a chance to avenge that. However, the Pelicans team we will see is one that is barnstorming of sorts. Since January 1st, they are the third best team in the NBA with the fifth ranked offense, the fifth ranked defense. They are one of four teams who have both a top 10 offense and a top 10 defense. Conventionally, that is considered an indicator of contender viability. Right now, the other three teams to accomplish that feat are the Celtics, the Nuggets, and the Oklahoma City Thunder, all heavyweights. This is a team that is playing great. At the best time, as they head towards the postseason, Trey Murphy is playing unbelievable ball. We'll get into all of that. But joining me on today's podcast is an authority on all things Pelicans. His name, Pelicans, did I say that correctly? His name, Shamit Dua, the author of the In the NO Substack. So thank you for joining me on today's podcast, Shamit.
Thank you for having me, Bob. I'm glad that we're able to take our Twitter banter and turn it into a podcast.
I look at our franchises, and I do think that there's a lot of parallels in many ways. Both of them loaded with talent, maybe not the construction that will ultimately push them over the top, but also, smaller markets, cognizant of spending, definitely in the case of the Pelicans, less so with Dan Gilbert at times. But at the moment, our teams are streaking in opposite directions. Can you kind of describe the mindset there amongst the fan base, how you feel about the team as they head towards the postseason specifically?
Yeah, so I think the fan base is split. There's a large contingency of fans who are super excited about the team. The fact that they're on track to, A, win the division for the first time since Chris Paul was here, B, hit 50 wins since the first time since Chris Paul was here, and then, just kind of watch the growth of these players that they've invested in for such a long time. And to watch that pay off is an exciting time for a lot of people. I definitely feel like the team also sees it that way in terms of this team has always been hampered by injuries, being able to have their key players unavailable, Zion, Brandon Ingram, even CJ's missed time. And it's been difficult to figure out who they truly are because of that. And this year, for the most part, knock on wood, they've been available, and it's led to great results. They have the fourth best net rating in the league. And then there's a smaller contingency of fans, analysts who are a little bit hesitant. They're like, okay, things are going well. How real is this? There's some underlying numbers that raise a lot of questions with regards to if this team is as good as some of their overall metrics say. So, I mentioned it, them being fourth in net rating, they're top 10 in offense, top 10 in defense. Those are typical.
Those are like the title barometer teams, typically.
Exactly. Those are signals for contender status. And I don't think, count me in the camp that thinks that this is not quite a team at that level yet, but it's certainly an exciting time because the conversation being, are they a contender or not, is so much better than the conversation being, how good are they even going to be when these guys get on the court? So I think it's super enjoyable to watch because of that. And they're going to head into the playoffs. Hopefully they're going to be healthy. And that's going to be so valuable in terms of the data they get back, data that they've been unable to gather in the 5 years since Zion's been drafted.
I think one of the storylines I find interesting is the success of Point Zion. This season, when recording 6 or more assists, the Pelicans are 18-4. So while he might have come into the league projected as this just unstoppable scoring force and athletic freak, he has been surrounded by a lot of very high-end role players, and it is benefiting these Pelicans greatly. And their drafting has been exceptionally good. You had that 2021 draft, the Mobley draft for the Cavs fans, and yet you could arguably make the case, I think, that the Pelicans, at least based on value relative to where they were drafted, came away as the definitive winners in that draft, getting Trey Murphy III in the mid-teens, and then landing Herb Jones with the 35th pick. Murphy's one of the best high-volume three-point shooters in the league. And Herb Jones is an all-world defender who just so happens to be shooting over 50% from three since the new year. Trey specifically, now he killed us in December. 28 points, hit 6 3-pointers. One thing that I found unbelievable when I was looking at the numbers is Sam Merrill is mired in just a terrible shooting slump at the moment. He is, I believe he's 6 of his last 35 three-point attempts, and that's over a 6-game span. In a comparable 6-game span, Trey Murphy is 32 for 64, shooting 50% from outside the arc. Yeah, seems pretty good. It tends to align where his best games produce the best results in wins. Trey Murphy is a plus 18.5, and in losses, he's a minus 12.2. Now, that's not to say that he's the singular factor, but his play as of late, I found extremely impressive. How do Pelican fans view Trey Murphy, you know, his play this season, Herb's play this season, in regards to their hierarchy within this Pelicans roster construction? Has this season changed anything?
So here's one thing I'll say. Both the organization and the fans, but more importantly, the organization, they view those two as the pillars of the franchise. They want to build around those guys, build with those guys long term, as long as it takes. And, you know, I've been someone who's been a Trey Murphy truther for the longest time. And to answer your question about, like, did anything change over the course of the season? The answer to that's no. So he came off a meniscus injury. He had surgery on it, came back, was scorching hot, was, you know, looked like what we expected Trey Murphy to be this season, which was, in my opinion, the conversation heading into the season was, can this guy be the third best player on the team? Can he be the second best player on the team? And maybe, you know, he's not capable of doing all of these amazing things that Brandon Ingram and CJ McCollum are capable of doing with the ball. But, like, in terms of impact and efficiency, does he have an argument for being that second or third best player? And when he came back early, like those, you know, first 7, 8, 9, I don't know how many games or so, like, it looked like, oh my gosh, like, yeah, he's making this a difficult conversation. And then there was this game against the Memphis Grizzlies. Marcus Smart ran through the back of his knee, the injured knee that he had a procedure on. Trey had to miss some time because of that. He, you know, he had to get some treatment, some, I think, fluid drain on his knee. And he just wasn't the same since coming back from that injury. He went on a big slump, and it was noticeable not only in his three-point production, but his free throw production. I mean, I believe he's 80% for the season at the moment. And this is a guy who hit 90% of over 90% the previous year, was 88% the year before that. I mean, he's a guy that flirts with the 90% mark.
He's basically a 50-40-90 lock, it seems like, moving forward.
Exactly. It's a pretty outlier situation for him to be, you know, a 78% guy. I mean, even going back to college, his last year at UVA, he was 60% from the floor, you know, 40% from three, 90% from. He was the only 50-40-90 player in college that year, you know. And so to him to be that kind of a guy and then now be below 80% on from the free throw line signifies that there's something wrong, something that needed some time. The All-Star break helped. Just having time removed from the injury helped. And so now he's found that sort of rhythm again. And I think we can start having some of those conversations again. I mean, it's a little bit premature, but as you say, like, there's a significant correlation between how Trey Murphy performs and the team performs. And if he's able to be a player that consistently performs at the kind of efficiency that he's been doing so, then this is going to be a very good team. And there's going to be some very difficult questions about who needs to start and who doesn't need to start and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, Trey is, I think, a foundational piece. Herb Jones, you know, the organization absolutely adores him for all, you know, for all the right reasons. He plays defense. He comes into work every single day. You know, he has all of those cliche things about, like, you know, like people say about, like, being like a coach's player and all that. Like, he has all of those, but he's a really, really good basketball player. And the one question with Herb Jones is always was, can he be effective offensively? Can he be someone that isn't a liability? And this season, he's not only answered that, he is like spitting in the face of opponents who want him to try to ramp up his usage. They're like, okay, like, you're going to leave me alone? I will make you pay. I will make you suffer. You know, he's been one of the most effective three-point shooters in the league. Percentage-wise, low volume. He's been one of the best finishers in the league. He's around 65% true shooting, and he's answered the call in every way possible on the offensive end.
Herb is an interesting parallel to me for a couple of reasons. I think the Cavaliers have a guy on their roster in Isaac Okoro who a lot of people view similarly in the sense that the leap that he made in three-point efficiency this year and the leap that he made just in transition scoring, it mirrors very similarly what the Cavs are seeing with Isaac Okoro, where it's low volume. I know Herb's around, you know, 3.5 threes a game, which is roughly similar to Okoro. Since the new year, I know Herb's been just out of his mind from three-point land. But Isaac Okoro now up over 40% on the season, getting out in transition and finishing at a very high rate, which was one of the things that I think goes unsung about Herb, is that he was, you know, he was a middle of the pack, like 50th percentile guy in transition last year. This year, he's damn near the best in the league. He's in the 90th percentile. Just to put it in context for Cavs fans, he is scoring more efficiently in transition than even Donovan Mitchell, who has been great for us in that capacity. He's a top 10 guy, Herb is. So one of the biggest causes of anxiety amongst Cavs fans is, well, what's going to happen with Okoro moving forward? We're a team that's poured a ton of money into our core four. He's coming up on restricted free agency. Unlike Herb, you know, he was a first-round pick. While they do have the ability to match anything, they didn't extend with him prior to the season. So he effectively bet on himself, and he's going to win that bet. He is having a great season. He either will make an All-NBA defensive team, or he'll be right there in the conversation. And you're looking at a guy who conceivably could cost you anywhere between $14 and $20 million, depending on what the outside leverage is. Herb's story I thought was interesting because in some ways it reminds me of what went down with Carlos Boozer, where he was let out of an option. Like the Pelicans didn't pick up the $1.8 million option, and they worked out a long-term deal. It roughly, the average annual value was $13.5 million a season. But if you look at it from the standpoint of, well, if you wanted to just assign the entire contract's value to the 3 years beyond, it would still only be $18 million a season, which seems like a steal considering what Herb's providing. And when I look at a guy, I look at your team specifically, the roster construction, the cost of keeping guys, knowing a decision is coming up on the horizon in terms of extending with Brandon Ingram or going a different way with it. And then you've got Trey Murphy, who, I mean, based on the numbers we talked about, it's somewhat similar to Mobley, where you're wondering, okay, is this guy, is it a certain thing you're looking at a rookie max? And does that change your outlook on guys like a Brandon Ingram or some of the other, you know, core pieces of your team who might push you into a financial space that you're uncomfortable in, similar to what we're dealing with our core four?
Yes. There's a lot to touch on there. I want to touch on Okoro first and foremost in that Herb comparison. What's pretty funny is that if you look at their per 36 numbers or even like their possession adjusted per 100 numbers, they're almost identical in terms of like points, rebounds, assists, steals. It's just that like Herb's like 10% maybe if more efficient, 5% more efficient here, 10% more efficient there, you know, like from the free throw line when it comes to finishing, maybe like, you know, 10% better on the steals, 10%. So it's just like that 10% can be an important differentiator in the playoffs, you know, when it comes to everything just being about the margins. I do think that Okoro, you know, what's funny is that there's another player kind of in the same vein is Jaden McDaniels in Minnesota, right? Very similar to the two players that we're talking about. Really good defensive guy, found his relative offensive efficiency last year, got paid about $126 million or so over 5 years. Big, big pricey bag. I think if Herb Jones was heading into free agency this summer, he'd be looking at something like that. So that's kind of the thing. If you're Isaac Okoro and you're in his representation, you're looking at Minnesota's situation. They were kind of taxed out at the moment. You know, they're going to be a second apron team next year. That was an expensive team, and they were like, "We're really good, so we're going to pay McDaniels." And if I'm Okoro's representation, I'm basically doing the same thing. It's like you don't have a pathway to replace Okoro's production, Okoro's defense on a team that needs wing production. Dan Gilbert is a very generous owner when it comes to paying the tax. So those are the levers that I'm pulling if I'm Okoro's representation. And, you know, if I'm the Cavs, I'm trying to get him somewhere closer to that Herb Jones deal, right? Or that Josh Green deal. That market's going to be pretty fascinating to watch shake out. But I think at this rate, I'd be surprised if he makes less money than Herb Jones specifically, just with the way the market is and that kind of stuff. Because last thing you want is like Detroit to like
swoop
throw
in
with $25 million.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and realistically too, I mean, I think we saw it a lot last summer. A lot of these guys, they wanted bigger deals. It got dragged out a little bit, and then they eventually settled for just over the mid-level or somewhere in that range where ultimately the question becomes, you know, who do you have to worry about? One, the Cavs haven't really shown a propensity to play hardball with people. Eventually, they come to terms. I mean, you look at Jared Allen. I think you could make an argument that in the summer that they gave him the 5-for-$100 million deal, the next biggest center contract that year was Holmes, who got $11 million a season. I think they probably could have got him back for 15 if they were willing to drag their feet, like how the Bulls did with Lauri Markkanen and then eventually traded him, where it's like, okay, I don't expect the Cavs to go down a road where they say, go bring me a competitive offer, because all they do is preach culture and chemistry, and clearly everybody loves the guy. But I will be curious to see where he lands, and I think it's safe. I totally agree with you. It's going to be more than what Herb's value is. If anything, I look at that Herb deal so jealously. Those are the types of deals where you got to make hard decisions, where you're kind of borrowing from the generosity of that deal, the team friendliness of that deal, maybe to have to retain some of these people who, you know, put you right up against those financial burdens. But part of the way that we interacted was so much in regards to, do the Cavaliers have to make a hard choice when it comes to their big men? And there's a lot of discussion about spacing lineups versus our conventional, you know, core four. Now, since the time that I, you know, jumped in my trench of, I don't want to break up these big men, it certainly has not really gone in my favor, I would say. It's not to say that, I mean, last season, the analytics were solid enough. Definitely not in the playoffs, though. It didn't work out. We added a bunch more shooting. My feeling all along has always been, and I look at your roster as one of these situations where, you know, you have your banger, bruiser, center, and Valanciunas, but if you choose to take him off the floor, you at least have the size and the length to be able to go away from that fairly comfortably. I was hoping that the Cavs could build a similar construction where there will be teams I feel like we need to deploy both Allen and Mobley, because they're not exactly bruiser centers. They're tall, they're long, but they can be out-physicaled by your Saboniss, your Valanciunas, that build where when you get into the playoffs, I mean, you're going to eventually run up against an Embiid, a Jokic, a Giannis, guys who can bully you. And I wanted the versatility. Whether you can sustain that financially when Mobley gets to his next deal is a whole nother situation. But I'm curious your thoughts watching this Cavalier team. If you were in charge of the Cavaliers, what would be your priority for things to do this summer to put this roster in a position that you think is the best for its future?
I mean, I hate to be sort of cliche here, but it revolves around Donovan first and foremost. And I think, you know, he's correct me if I'm wrong, he is going to be eligible for an extension, although not that like mega super max extension because of games missed and, you know, he wasn't drafted by the Cavs and that kind of thing. But like, nonetheless, he's going to be up for a 30% max either
way. Yeah. Yeah.
My
understanding is we could sign him to a deal that would be roughly around $52 million, average annual value, $54 million, somewhere in that neighborhood.
Right. And that's kind of the same deal that Ingram is in line for. And so priority number one, securing that, you know, just putting it on the table, securing that. I will say, as an organization, I'm willing, you know, as an individual, I'm willing to take more risk than a lot of organizations do. So if he doesn't take that right off the bat, but he also doesn't say, I don't want it, like, you know, I want to be traded, I'm okay riding the season out. I think the Cavs are in position to be very good and to be good for a long time. So let's set aside the issue of him securing that money or not. Let's look at the rest of the roster. The first thing I see is redundancy a little bit in the backcourt in terms of you got two guys that are under 6'4", that aren't the best defenders and both sort of function best with the ball in their hands. And so they've had a lot of success together. They've produced a lot of wins together. This season, you know, the analytics have strongly been in the favor of the single guard, you know, single small guard orientation rather than like the double small guard orientation. I would see if a Darius Garland could turn into a Mikal Bridges. You know, I would see if a Darius Garland could turn into one of these big two-way wings that I think would take the Cavs to the next level, right? I don't know if that kind of a deal is out there. I think it's well worth exploring. Likewise, I'm looking at the bigs, and first of all, I'm finding out which one Donovan likes to play with more.
Well, I think the numbers would suggest that that's clearly Jared Allen.
And I think, you know, it's one of those things where, like, look, if you've secured Donovan to a long-term deal, you have more flexibility in moving a guy like Mobley. I would never suggest any team move their third overall pick prior to his second deal, especially when he's been really good. Like, I don't think that's good team building. But I'm saying if that's a conversation they ever wanted to entertain, because Allen is very, very good, and the pairing of Mitchell and Allen is very, very good, Mobley can also go fetch someone very, very good that might fit better.
Well, let me ask you this from your perspective. Would you think that Mobley garners more in his current state on his rookie deal or after he's re-signed? If you're a team who's after Mobley, do you see a difference in perceived value based on which one of those scenarios he would hit the market?
The perceived value to me at that point is getting him sooner rather than later. If you're all the way in on Mobley, then you want him today rather than tomorrow, because what if he gets hurt? You know, what if something happens, whatever, like, you want him today.
I get that. I think on the opposite side of that, it may be difficult to recoup something of reasonable value in return for him if we went that route. I kind of agree with what you said.
Yeah.
That the first order of operation is, I'm not doing a goddamn thing till I see what happens with Donovan Mitchell. And I, too, share your feeling that whether he extends this summer or not, the general avenue of superstar movement is take the money now, force your way out later. The Cavs have more leverage than many on the outside would have you believe. Now, as far as Evan Mobley goes, he's the one that makes me more apprehensive, because without Donovan, this team isn't winning anything. If, though, Donovan's on a fat new deal and you then sign Mobley to a rookie max, the unintended butterfly effect could be that it eventually pushes Jared Allen off the roster.
So here's my question to you is, you know, if you're the Cavs, is your opening offer the rookie max? Because, like, you look at Jaren Jackson Jr. extended at the sub-max rate. Mobley's a better rebounder than Jaren Jackson Jr. Jaren Jackson Jr., I think, is better offensively. And so, like, I think defensively, like, you know, they're probably neck and neck. Jaren Jackson having the benefit of the doubt, winning defensive player of the year.
With 1,000 less minutes. Disgusting. We'll get in.
Right. So I would say, you know, it's roughly a wash there in terms of defense. Both kind of have been at their best when there's another big next to them. And both have been kind of shaky in terms of impact, not in terms of like how good they are, because I think they still produce when they're like the single big, but like in terms of impact, like I think Jaren Jackson's impact is like much lower when he's the center versus like when he's next to Steven Adams, because he doesn't get to be the weak side guy who just comes over and just, you know, demolishes everything. Same thing with Mobley. You know, a lot of his impact metrics have been fantastic when he's next to Allen specifically. Separate the two, Allen as a single big stands up a little better than Mobley. And I don't know if it's just because of the physicality stuff. I just don't know if it's, you know, like not being the same kind of offensive force or what it is, or am I mistaken in that?
No, I don't think you're mistaken. Definitely not analytically speaking this season. Anyway, this season is weird in that last season, I did think, I mean, we were one of those teams that we talked earlier about, the top 10 corollary and blah, blah, blah. The core four was perfectly fine last year. It's just we got into this season and we've had huge stretches of games where they have simply not played a lot together, because we had that entire stretch from essentially the first time we faced off all the way to the end of January where we're playing without Mobley and Garland. Allen and Mitchell were just sending their numbers through the roof. Now, since they've come back, it's not that the metrics between Garland and Mitchell on the floor together are bad, because they really aren't. Justin Rowan would kill me if I didn't mention that they're nearly a +8. It's just Donovan by himself has been closer to a +10. So it's not that the two guards aren't effective. I think the bigger issue is that the core four, the unit we need to analyze, has logged a total of 305 minutes together. They're a positive net rating. They hover around a 4, but that sample is unacceptably low. So it's a frustrating thing, because I sit here when I see, well, we got to blow up the bigs and stuff. Part of me is like, I want more time. I don't know if it's realistic to expect that we'll ever necessarily feel, okay, we've got a comfortable runway of seeing all these guys. We may get to a point where we're forced to make some hard decisions before that ever happens.
Just kind of going back to that, like that double big orientation. Like, I think drawing a parallel back to the Pelicans, like the Pelicans with Zion and Brandon Ingram were like, these guys keep getting hurt. We don't have the data. We don't have the sample. I don't know what to do with it. But should we just make a move without knowing? I think they got to the precipice of making that decision this past summer when they were involved in the Scoot Henderson talks. You know, I think they were really pushed to their limits on that. And eventually, obviously, decided to walk away from those talks and not pull the trigger. I think including Brandon Ingram in that deal to Charlotte would have gotten the deal done. That's based on, you know, everything I've heard and things that have been reported. And, you know, obviously, I think there was discussion around trading Zion as well for, again, the idea of getting Scoot. So they decided not to do that this year. They held on to him. They thought that, okay, we could buy ourselves more time. Brandon's still not on his next deal yet. Zion's contract is going to be flat. It's going to be not flat. Sorry, that's the wrong terminology. It's going to be the max. We know what it is. Like, it's not going to have an unexpected change. That decision has paid off for them. It easily could have backfired. Both those guys could have gotten hurt, could have had another year, a wasted year, but it has paid off for them this year. And now they're looking like a team that's going to head to the playoffs with those two guys available, and they're going to find out a lot more, right? Similar to what you've been wanting out of those two picks. I think what complicates things for the Cavs and the Pelicans is the contractual timelines for everybody just accelerate some of these decisions in a way that you're not ready as an individual or as like a data gatherer to make, right? And so going back to Mobley and Allen, I did think there was a lot of signal rather than noise in that stretch. Even though you guys beat up a lot of bad teams, the quality of shots you were generating, the way you guys were just kind of like, it was like a flamethrower every single night. Like, you were demolishing teams. So there was something in that process where I think is a lot more signal than noise in terms of like, okay, Allen plus Mitchell plus all these shooters works. But you want to be careful that you're not recreating the Utah Jazz, because that's what the Utah Jazz was. Mitchell, Gobert, bunch of shooters. But where they always found themselves limited was not Gobert's ability to defend in space, in my opinion, but everybody else's ability to defend that Gobert couldn't overcome. Now, I think Cleveland's job, I think they have a pathway to be something better, because I think Garland and Mobley could fetch some of these proverbial big wings that can defend across multiple positions, that don't leave Mitchell as vulnerable, that don't, like, you know, you don't have Joe Ingles and Bogdanovich as your wing stoppers, you know, and a 6'2 Mike Conley, you know, again, like the Mikal's like the name that I keep throwing out there. I'm like, if you had a Mikal Bridges, I'm looking at that team fundamentally differently than I am looking at it with, you know, if like Max Strus is your biggest wing, or like even Okoro is like your biggest wing, who is like fantastic defensively, still on the smaller end in terms of like, can you trust them against, well, like if you're going against Boston Celtics, like, you know, you could probably put him on one of Tatum or Brown, but like, who guards the other guy, you know?
I would like to give you a stat on Isaac Okoro. I prepared it for the debate that I see coming about all defensive teams. But against Jaylen Brown this year, Isaac Okoro held Brown to 1-for-11. He scored 2 points in the 8 minutes they've matched up. One of the more favorable Isaac Okoro matchups. So I would imagine if we faced Boston, that would probably be the first look. But again, it kind of depends.
So then who's on Tatum, right?
Like, Tatum is either going to be a Mobley or a Dean Wade in all likelihood. I mean, it depends who's starting. If Mobley's in the lineup, it's going to be Mobley. He always gets multiple looks over the course of the game. It's never a one-man assignment there. So Okoro will get some minutes too. I wanted to, I think it's a good transition point to talk about all-NBA defense, because Herb specifically is a guy who, I feel like this conversation is starting to pick up steam. Do you have a place in mind that you think Jones deserves to be? And do you see any Cavaliers on first team or second team all-NBA defense?
Let me start with the second question. I think Allen should not only be first team, but he should be like top three for defensive player of the year. What the Cavs have been able to do defensively has been a large part due to him being kind of, I don't want to diminish the team as a whole, but like, he's been kind of like this one man anchor. And like, he's been fundamentally like one of the best pick and roll defenders in the league on, you know, a per possession basis. Everything you want out of a defensive anchor, he's done. He's protected the rim. He's terminated possessions by cleaning up the glass. He has been scheme versatile in the sense that, like, he's gone out to guard, you know, meet guards at the screen. He's played drop. He's done everything you can ask. And so, like, you know, if the Wolves weren't having the defensive season they were having, you know, Allen should be a favorite for the defensive player of the year. Unfortunately, you know, or fortunately, however you want to view it, I think Gobert's the guy.
Yeah.
So he'd be your other, you know, first defense guy. So there's two for me.
So you've got Gobert and Allen. And you pointed out Allen is, in fact, if you want to base it off Vegas odds, he's third right now. How would you round out your first team all defense?
See, I think this is where it gets tough. So I think in Boston, Derek White and Jrue Holiday both have arguments.
Could you argue, though, that they have the same issue that Mobley and Allen had last year? The Cavs were the first team, they were the best defense in the NBA. And to some extent, it felt like the biggest bullet in the chamber used against them was, well, you know, they have the luxury of playing alongside one another.
Yeah. I mean, like, I'm not going to use a bad argument to make another bad argument. I do think that, like, you know, it's unfortunate what happened with Allen and Mobley, but, like, it's a bad argument from that time. You know, that it was a bad argument then, still a bad argument now.
Okay.
I think, you know, I like Jrue better as a player, but I would probably have to give the nod to White. I am biased. I am putting Herb Jones on the first team, given what the Pelicans have been able to accomplish defensively, given what he's been able to accomplish defensively. He's the fourth. And on the fifth is where it gets really tricky, right? I think the positionless stuff makes it a little bit more valuable of an exercise because, like, look, you look at what Anthony Davis has done, and I'm like, okay, well, this guy's been incredible. Maybe he deserves it. I think you look at what Caruso's done. You're like, this guy's been incredible. Maybe he deserves it. Both their teams have been like, you know, defensively, right? I think there's arguments for guys like, I feel like there's an argument for a guy like KCP. You know, I feel like there's a guy, there's an argument for a guy like Chet. There's an argument for Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. There's some really good defensive teams out there that have some standout defenders. And I think it's just at this point for that fifth player, you just kind of picking nits. Okay. A little bit, unless there's, like, you know, some standout that I'm absolutely missing. And like I said, like, if it ends up being a Coro, I'm not upset. I'm not going to be like, so-and-so was robbed, unless it was Herb Jones that was robbed. And then in that case, he was robbed.
Right. All hell to pay. I'll tell you this. I went into this exercise. I probably spent 2 hours today just looking at advanced metrics to go along with, because obviously I've seen a lot of these guys. I have my feelings about just eyeball test stuff. But here's what I was shocked to find out. I feel like this is my first team All-NBA defense. Now, it's hard for me as a person who loves big men not to just load up on centers, because it is. I do feel like the award is just so weighted towards them in some ways. But I think there's two sure things for All-NBA defense. And I realize the Spurs are not a good team defense, but Wemby is just so analytically overwhelming in some ways. I think Gobert is the absolute lock, the defensive player of the year. I think Wemby should be first team All-NBA defense. I think Allen, I mean, my heart says I want it to be Allen. Although of the five people I'm about to tell you, I think that he has the most tenuous case, because I think Herb is a lock. I don't think it's debatable. I think Herb and Caruso are the two guys that I would pick as far as wing perimeter defenders who would make it for me. I don't believe that's what's going to happen. I believe one of Derek White or Jrue Holiday is going to make first team. But I think as it relates to analytics specifically, when you look at things like, you know, defensive Darko, defensive LeBron, defensive box plus minus, all those things, deflections, block percentage, rebounds, rim defense, Caruso blows away every guard in all those analytics. Now, the mark against him would, of course, be people who look at the Bulls and say, well, the team isn't good enough. I'm not going to give him the nod. The Boston Celtics are the best defense in the NBA for huge portions of the season, and they have two dominant guards. And certainly, Derek White, one of the best shot-blocking guards we've seen in the modern era here. But I think there's four guys who I absolutely would put first team: Gobert, Wemby, Herb, and Caruso. And then that fifth spot, I go back and forth on whether it would be Allen, whether it would be Anthony Davis, whether it would be Bam Adebayo, whether it would be Derek White. I personally would put White in before I put Drew Holiday. Okoro, as much as I would love, I think Okoro, his biggest argument is when you look at what he's done in his individual matchups against the best player on the other team. Damian Lillard, Kobe White, Ant Edwards, Jaylen Brown, Tyrese Maxey, Paolo Banchero, Scottie Barnes, all of them have struggled mightily with Isaac Okoro as the primary defender. The problem is you have to look pretty far under the hood to find that. The advanced all-encompassing metrics, those are pretty pedestrian. It puts him on the same level as Drew, roughly, but it puts him significantly behind Herb, Caruso, and Derek White. They all have an edge in advanced metrics. Conversely, the reason I might diminish a guy like Shai Gilgeous-Alexander despite advanced metrics is because the eyeball test gives added context that tells you that Lu Dort is the one drawing the toughest assignments night in and night out. I mean, Suggs to me would be right there. Holiday to me would be right there. Shai would be right there. Okoro would be right there. All those, to me, those are the perimeter-oriented guys, KCP too, who are battling for second team. But my first team would be Rudy, Wemby, Herb, Caruso, and either Allen or Anthony Davis. I feel like where Allen so many times has, he doesn't compile block shots from a counting stats perspective, but he can protect the rim at an elite level. He contests, I mean, he's the 97th percentile of rim contests, and he can switch and pick up guys. I'm not saying he's going to lock everyone down, but ask any Cavs fan about how he did in isolation situations against Luka last year, and they'll sing his praises to the ends of the earth. I think because Mobley is so positionally versatile, and he can guard out to the perimeter, and he led the league in contested three-point shots last year, Allen gets lost a little in the shuffle in terms of he can do many of those things. It's just it gets muted by the fact that Mobley's been there. But this season, I'm hoping, I truly hope, I do think that Allen should be a first-team all-defense guy, because I think if you look at the Cavs' performance, second or third-best defense most of the way, and him being there, having to man the middle largely by himself for huge stretches of this season, I don't think that you could argue anything in the way of this isn't Allen's most impressive defensive season and really his most impressive season overall. I hope that it happens. I guess I'm just skeptical because I think we can both acknowledge that all defensive teams tend to have a legacy component that may carry on beyond necessarily when you're the deserving choice as like so the
speaking,
all defensive.
Speaking
guy.
Of those legacy components, there's two guys we haven't talked about who like have the weight of a big market and have the legacy. It's Kawhi Leonard and Paul George. And it's like, okay, well, those guys have been relatively available this year. And you know, in any given year, you could be like, those guys are you know, worthy of it. And they have the accolades and the history and blah, blah, blah. But it's just like, it seems like for all the talk about they're not really being a league that plays defense, there's a lot of really, really good defenders that you could put on these teams.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I thought one of the most impressive things with Isaac Okoro, though, is my hope when I have these conversations with people who cover other teams extensively is that I can spread my Okoro propaganda to them. When I look at the head-to-head matchups, I'm looking for one thing specifically that I think is a pretty good general barometer of the kind of job that a defender does, and that's what I would call like a one-to-one ratio. If a guy's scoring a point for every minute you're defending him, if you can come out on the right side of that equation where you logged more minutes covering him than points that he scored, then generally speaking, you did a pretty good job. And Isaac Okoro has had fantastic outings this season. He's shown that he can guard small to big. Really, the only guy who is exploited in this season is somebody that you brought up, who I think most people would say is having a down season in Mikal Bridges. But he lit us up the other night, and he's had an incredible run of success against Okoro. But by and large, Okoro's held up excellently against what's always the first option on the other team. I'm hoping that a year removed from right now, people are talking about Okoro the way that they're talking about Herb Jones this season.
No, it'd be incredible, and I think he's young enough to make it happen, too. You know, he's 23. Not in his prime, even. You know?
No, a lot of room to grow here. So can we talk about the... I wanted to ask your opinion on two things. These are straight up clickbait type subjects. This isn't about on-court basketball. This is just relitigating the past. The 2021 draft. I'm going to give you a list of names, and I want you to tell me Cade Cunningham, Evan Mobley, Scottie Barnes, Franz Wagner, Alperen Şengün. Are there any of those guys that you would put Trey and Herb above if you had to redraft right now?
I think this lends itself to the classic question of high usage guy as like a primary versus, I think we've talked about this on Twitter, versus a star in their role player. If I'm a current playoff team, I'm probably taking, this is going to be, oh my God, you're going to clip this and you put this on Twitter. I'm ready for it. If I'm a current playoff team, I'm taking Herb Jones over Scotty Barnes. The reason I'm taking Herb Jones over Scotty Barnes is that I think Scotty is a difficult fit in teams that already have good primary playmakers. And he isn't quite that good defensively, though he's a decent event generator. Like, you know, he can get blocks, he can get steals. He's not a stopper. His play hasn't really led to a lot of wins. But like, if I'm a 30-win team and I'm trying to be a 40-win team, I'm going to take Scotty Barnes. But if I'm a 50-win team trying to make it to round two in the conference finals, give me Herb Jones. I feel similarly about Trey Murphy. I think Franz Wagner is kind of like the litmus test. I think he could probably be very good in any given setting, in any given situation. I think he's just flat out good. Evan Mobley. Okay, so let's do this exercise, and it's a little bit difficult because there's already a lot of established bigs. But like, if you were to go down like Western Conference playoff teams in order, who do you think they would rather have? So like Minnesota Timberwolves, would they rather have Mobley or Herb Jones? And that's a little bit unfair because they have so many bigs, and I feel like they would pick Herb Jones, right? Let's go down to the Thunder. Who would they have, Herb Jones or Mobley? And now I'm terrified of a Mobley and Chet front court. OKC's weakness is rebounding. Functionally, I'm not losing any spacing replacing Giddy with Herb Jones. I mean, sorry, with Evan Mobley. Like, there's no really like spacing loss there. So I think OKC probably picks Mobley.
But what if I put it on your team specifically? Would you take
That's
Mobley
tough.
Over a Herb Jones or a Trey Murphy?
That's super tough. Yeah, I would say, given the Pelicans' options available at the wing versus at their big man spot, I think Mobley is more valuable to them. A team that's CJ, Trey Murphy, Brandon Ingram, Zion, and Mobley seems like a pretty terrifying team. You might be losing a perimeter stopper. The Pelicans do have good perimeter defenders in Dyson Daniels, who I think is a better defender than Herb Jones on the ball. I think Herb's a little bit more versatile, but Dyson, I think, is just better on the ball. Najee's been pretty good for them. He's no Herb Jones. Both those guys are worse offensively right now than Herb Jones, but there's pathways to kind of like replacing that production. Pathway to getting someone like Mobley is non-existent. It's one of those things where like who you have on your roster kind of dictates who you want. So I think that makes the conversation fascinating because like I think in a vacuum, Mobley's a better player, but because of the positional differences and positional importance, Herb might end up fitting more contending level teams or as many contending level teams. So even if it's an equal number, I think that's pretty incredible given one's the third pick, one's the 35th pick.
Well, and I think that's what made this conversation with you something I wanted to do, because in a lot of ways I look at your roster and I look at our roster and I say the holes that everybody is desperate for on this end are things that you have in ample supply, and the things that we seem to have in ample supply are the things that maybe that you would be seeking out. But that, as far as that Scotty Barnes comment goes, I think that that was a completely reasonable take. I think a more outrageous take would be this one.
I feel like giraffes are clumsy enough to where like you could
this
like,
is a terrible idea.
They're so big.
Look,
it is very big. It's a high risk, like high reward play, right?
You're a real competitor, man. I got to give you that.
This is like really fucked up because like I'm vegetarian and like I don't even like think about animals in this regard. But like, look, you put me in a life and death situation. No. But if it wasn't, you know, I feel like if you take out one of the legs, like you win. But if you can't, you're done. That's it. It's a one shot gambit.
Now that was from your appearance on the Divine Intervention with Dan Devine, and he asked you who you'd fight. He didn't give you a list of animals to choose from. You kind of unprompted selected one of the biggest animals out there. And I like how you referred to it as a high risk, high reward proposition. Now that you've had a couple weeks to think it over, is there a different animal that you wish maybe you would have picked?
I think there's two things going on here. The way I interpreted the question was, which one would you have a chance against? Not as like, which one would you be a heavy favorite for, right? I don't think in any of those situations versus this hypothetical giraffe, I'd be favorite. But like, is there a pathway to victory? And in that moment, I thought there was a pathway to victory. Now, I got off that podcast and I Googled how much do giraffes weigh, and the average giraffe male human, not human, sorry, average giraffe weighs 2,600 pounds. 2,600 pounds. So one of those legs that I'm trying to take off is probably 600 pounds. Yeah, it's not happening.
Okay. Well, see, when now that's the other thing. When it says take on an animal, I think that you gave it the most, you know, difficult to answer interpretation, because sometimes I would think about it. If I was asked that question, I would think, what animal can I evade long enough to survive? Not necessarily what could I, you know, beat to death with my bare hands, you know, like, so I would be looking at animals. If I had to pick a big animal, I'd be looking for one that's just like not very laterally mobile, or I'd pick a huge fish and then I'd get the fuck out of the water. That would be how I would answer the question.
I think the setting determines it, right? If it's like you're in a Roman Colosseum, because like you look at persistent hunters and what they did was they took down very large animals by simply outrunning them. And okay. Right, because like humans evolutionarily have the ability to cool themselves off with their sweat. A lot of animals don't have that kind of function, and so like, can you just keep chasing them long enough to where they fatigue themselves out and the human doesn't? I think college me, who is the long distance runner, could have a wide variety of answers. Current me coming off of a broken leg does not have the same options. And so it's got to be more of a high risk, high reward gambit. There's no persistent hunting going on here. So, you know, I think like everything, location, it matters what your setting is and what you have available. Like if you're in a jungle, then, you know, like you presumably have access to like trees and branches and stuff that you can use makeshift tools out of, or like, you know, like get some vines and turn it into like a impromptu rope or something. But like, if, like I said, if it's a Roman Colosseum and it's just your bare hands, way different setting.
I love that you were willing to come on and talk about all these things. This got far more, you know, fantasy GM-ish than maybe I initially intended, but it's because I find your roster so intriguing. And I think,
well, so I wanted to, before you hit the conclusion on this, I did wanted to ask you, since you asked me, what would you do with the Pelicans, knowing what you have learned about the Pelican situation, given our conversations and just as an outside observer? They're coming into this postseason with the Brandon Ingram extension looming over their head, the Trey Murphy extension looming over their head. They have CJ, who is an aging but small guard, who's been good. Given that landscape, what would you do?
I think for me, Ingram would be the one that has the least solid hold on his position in the hierarchy. With Murphy where he is in terms of coming up on a second deal, I would do whatever it took to keep him. If your ownership was really dead set against, you know, if they did not believe that this team is a team you would want to extend yourself into the luxury tax for, I would be looking at, well, what can we recoup for Ingram? Maybe not in terms of, you know, we won't get comparable money back, or maybe we will in the short term, but the goal would be able to replace as much of his production and perhaps address more important needs at a better price tag. Now, CJ, I feel mostly the same about. I just don't think you can recoup nearly as much on an open market as you could for a Brandon Ingram. Brandon will give you more options, I would have to believe. Now, what about you? If you have to choose, would you extend him at a full max, or would you shop him first?
I think the cop-out answer is I look at the price of both of them on the open market. And if Ingram's returning an inordinate amount, then it has to be Ingram. So if Ingram, in this hypothetical example, we've danced around it, if Ingram can return a Mobley, then it has to be Ingram. If Ingram is just going to return picks and salary, and meanwhile, CJ's you know, going to return a net neutral value, then I keep the higher upside, younger, better player. I have time to figure it out. I don't think Ingram's going to be untradeable on his contract in any stretch of the imagination. And so I'm not concerned with that. It's just more like, okay, can I reshuffle CJ's money into positions of need, depth, to where it's just not like, you know, $30 million for a guy who's just been very good and the ultimate professional for them. It's, I do think there's a shelf life there. And as you mentioned, there's a more important driving factor, which is their crunch against the tax. This has just not been an ownership that is willing to pay that much. And I do think they'll pay once they're a very, very good team. Do I think CJ's on that version of that very, very good team? Possible, unlikely. You know, just right now, their core trio, big three, Brandon Ingram, Zion Williamson, CJ McCollum, they're net negative on the season. Since, you know, January the 23rd, since they went to point Zion, it's gotten even worse, right? It's like a minus four almost. And it's in that stretch. When you look at their three guys, if you look at Zion and BI and you look at their numbers with JV minus CJ, they're like plus 17. But if you look at their numbers with CJ minus JV, they're like minus seven. So it's like a lot of blame is being placed upon JV as like the weak link, where I feel like maybe it's CJ. And it's weird to say, because I think in the early part of the season, for the first 40 games or so, CJ was arguably their most important player, arguably their best player. And he's done everything from an organizational standpoint to change his shot profile, to be this like super professional off the court, to be the guy that kind of legitimizes what was a little bit of a joke of a franchise prior to CJ's arrival. Like, there was just a lot of drama. They were just in the headlines for the wrong reasons. And CJ got there, and I think has been a huge part of like changing the tune of like what this team is and what it's become. So it's like, shit, like you make a decision of moving that guy who's done so much for your org. But I think like if Boston is able to move a guy like Marcus Smart, there should be no qualms in moving a guy like CJ. It is what it is.
With CJ, oftentimes when I look at your roster, I think with what is happening with Zion and the point Zion situation, could you get by with something that's 80% of what he gives you offensively that just costs you far less? Because you don't require him to play all this conventional point guard style all the time. So in that regard, I kind of...
It's Jordan Hawkins, right? And yeah. It's like, Jordan Hawkins, certainly not the dribbler or the playmaker CJ is, but like definitely a movement shooter. Yeah. And so like if you decide your starting lineup is this jumbo lineup configuration of Zion at the point, then you got Trey and Herb and BI and whatever big you got, maybe it's JV, maybe it's not. That is a unique way to build a team, which I think uniqueness is necessary for winning, period. Do you trust your development and scouting enough to develop a guy like Jordan Hawkins into the CJ role, who is right now going to be like, you know, he's making $5-6 million compared to CJ's 30. So he's going to be a sixth of the cost for the foreseeable future. And there's also Dyson Daniels, right? And there's pathways, and they have all these picks and everything else. So like you said, there's pathways to finding an X percentage of CJ at a Y price, and that Y price being considerably lower.
Can you explain one more thing for my Cavs fan audience, which is the situation you're in with the conveyance of the first round pick this summer?
The Pelicans straight up own the Lakers' current pick, the 2024 pick. They have a deadline to where they can decide they don't want it and they can punt it to next year. And so the deadline is June 1st. And the lottery is May 12th. So if the Lakers miss the playoffs and, you know, they're like the 13th best odds, 14th best odds, but, you know, May 12th, lotto happens and they jump into the top four, the Pelicans can be like, yeah, we want this pick this year. And then the Lakers get the 25, like their own 25 pick. But if the Lakers don't move up and it's the 14th, Pelicans have about 3 weeks or so to kind of bring in guys that they want to work out or maybe find a trade for that pick. But if they decide, okay, like it's just not worth it, we don't want the Lakers pick, we're just going to roll it back to next year, they can punt it. And they were like, all right, so then LA will draft at 14 or whatever. Now this is separate from the Pelicans' own pick, which is going to be in the 20s because of their record. So they can have two picks this year. Most likely they're probably just going to pick one unless there's incredible luck with the Lakers pick.
So you think if it ends up mid-teens, they'll push it back to next season, if you had to guess?
I think so. I think this draft isn't like all that great from a value perspective. I think they have a good enough scouting team that they believe in that they can find guys like Herb and Najee and Jose like later on in the draft, to where, you know, having their current pick in the 20s is probably a similar value to like drafting in like 14, and you don't get the additional cap hit of it being a better first round pick. Unless, of course, you know, there's just a deal out there where some team's like, no, we want that specific pick. And they're like, okay, cool. Then we're going to work a deal around that. Like, it also could be a team that wants that specific pick and is giving you two really good picks in the future or something like that. You know, it just right. could be one of those.
Like things. The Shangoon situation. That
evolved. Sure.
Now, ideal playoff matchup. Do you have somewhere you want to land in this? In the, 'cause there is a bit of a chasm after the Clippers. Do you have a viable top four matchup there?
Minnesota.
Okay.
Yeah, Minnesota, I think they've matched up really well against when they were fully healthy, but they being Minnesota being fully healthy. And now that they're not fully healthy with Towns, I think I'd prefer that over Denver. Of course, no one wants to see Denver. I would prefer that over the Clippers. Though the Pelicans have played the Clippers well. They've beat them with a healthy, you know, they beat them on the road recently in LA with a completely healthy Clippers. Zion took that game over at the end of the game. So I think there's a good matchup there. It's just that, like, man, there's just I don't like going up against a Ty Lue coach team with that much star power. I think when it comes to matching up star for star, the Pelicans fall short. But when it comes to matching up depth for depth, the Pelicans are very, very good. So like Minnesota, I'd prefer. I don't mind seeing OKC. Whatever needs to happen to make that calculus work, Minnesota's the one.
Okay. Well, then I think that just leaves the prediction for the Cavs and Pelicans. What do you think is going to happen?
I think the Pelicans are going to win. And I think the Pelicans are probably it's going to be a low scoring affair for both teams, probably something under 110 for both teams. And I think the Pelicans come out on top because their role players are going to shoot better from three than the Cavs role players on the road. It's my prediction.
See, that's the part I'm going to clip. And then I'm going to put highlights over it, play it on loop, and finish it off with this Stephen A. Smith soundbite.
I don't give a shit.
So, okay, thank you for joining me. If people want to check out your Substack, the address
is inthenow.substack.com.
And as far as your Twitter handle, what's the origin of Fear the Brown, since it's dangerously close to at Fear the Fropod?
One was a little bit of a play on just like, you know, I think, not to get like too political here, but there was like, you know, like post like 9/11, like there was a difficult time for brown people in the United States. And like, I had very formative experiences during that time and just kind of like developed a little bit of a sense of humor around that. And I went on a lot of flights just as a young adult, where I would always be selected for random screenings and all that kind of stuff. So there was a little bit of tongue in cheek of like Fear the Brown. But it was also coinciding with when the Pelicans were drafting Anthony Davis, who was Fear the Brow. And so it was a good opportunity to kind of like mesh two things that like I think were a part of my life at that point. And I was like, cool, that's just going to be my handle. So So one heavier, one lighter, still funny nonetheless.
Okay, so you can follow him at Fear the Brown. Shamit Dua, thank you very much for taking the time to join the Fear the Fro podcast, and good luck against the Cavaliers. Although I'm saying that, you know, I don't mean it.
That's right. I'm going to suit up. I'm going to need all that luck.
Okay. So that'll do it, Cavalier fans. Shamit Dua, In the Know, his Substack. Check it out. I'm very appreciative of the time he gave me. Hopefully you took something away from this. If nothing else, I think we had a productive conversation about all NBA defensive teams and expectations. Don't get them too high. If Jared Allen makes first team, that's a win for all of us. Isaac Okoro, that's found money, as far as I'm concerned. Please, if you haven't already, leave a rating, a review in your podcast platform of choice, and I will be back with more Cavalier coverage on the Fear the Fro podcast.
Okay, that's enough.
Stop it!
This has been another
Fear the Fro.
It's over!
Podcast.
That was pathetic.
If you enjoyed what you heard today,
put it on the highlight reel.
Please consider subscribing.
Check out fropod.com for more Cavaliers and NBA coverage.
That's what's on display here.